me, William said. You are always welcome in my house, the PM replied graciously. About as much as a snake, the ambassador knew. The hi-how-are-you chit-chat lasted for 10 minutes. Spouses were fine. Children were fine. Grandchildren were fine. Yes, it was warming up with the approach of summer. So, what business do we have to discuss? I understand that your navy has sailed. Yes, it has, I believe. After the unpleasantness your forces inflicted on us, they had to make repairs. I suppose they are making sure all their machines work, the PM replied. Just exercises, Williams asked. My government merely asks the question, madam. Mr. Ambassador, I remind you that we are a sovereign nation. Our armed forces operate under our law, and you keep reminding us that the sea is free for the innocent passage of all. Are you now telling me that your country wishes to deny us that right? Not at all, Prime Minister. We merely find it curious that you are evidently staging so large an exercise. He didn't add, with your limited resources. Mr. Ambassador, no one likes to be bullied. Only a few months ago you falsely accused us of harboring aggressive intentions to a neighbor. You threatened our country. You actually staged an attack on our navy and damaged our ships. What have we done to merit such unfriendly acts? She asked, leaning back in her chair. Unfriendly acts was not a phrase used lightly, the ambassador noted, and was not accidentally spoken here. Madam, there has been no such act. I would suggest that if there were misperceptions, perhaps they were mutual, and to prevent further such errors, I come here to ask a simple question. America makes no threats. We simply inquire as to the intentions of your naval forces. And I have answered. We are conducting exercises. A moment before, Williams noted, she had supposed that something was going on. Now she seemed more certain of it. Nothing more. Then my question is answered, Williams commented with a benign smile. Jesus, but she thought she was clever. Williams had grown up in one of America's most complex political environments, the Pennsylvania Democratic Party, and had fought his way to the top of it. He'd met people like her before, just less sanctimonious. Lying was such a habit for political figures that they thought they could always get away with it. Thank you, Prime Minister. The engagement was a wipeout, the first such in this training rotation. Pretty bad timing, Ham thought, watching the vehicle returning up the dirt roads. They'd headed into it just after the President's announcement. They were guardsmen, and they were far from home, and they were worried about their families. That had distracted them badly, since they hadn't had time to let things settle down a little, to call home and make sure things were okay with Mom and Dad or Honey and the kids. And they'd paid for it. But professional soldier that he was, Ham knew it wasn't fair to mark this one down against the Carolina Brigade. This sort of thing wouldn't happen in the field. Realistic as the NTC was, it was still play. Nobody died here except by accident. While at home, the real thing might well be taking place. That wasn't how it was supposed to be with soldiers, was it? Clark and Chavez had their blood drawn by an army medic who also ran the screening test. They watched it with morbid fascination, especially since the medic wore thick gloves and a mask. They're both clean, he told them, with a sigh of his own. Thanks, Sarge, Chavez said. It was very real now. His dark Latino eyes were showing something other than relief. Like John, Domingo was putting on his mission face. With that, they bundled into an official car for the drive to Andrews. The streets in the Washington metropolitan area were unusually empty. It made for a swift passage that didn't assuage the sense of foreboding they both felt. Crossing one of the bridges, they stopped and had to wait for 3 other vehicles to pass a checkpoint. There was a National Guard Hummer in the middle of the eastbound lanes, and when Clark pulled up,
He showed his CIA picture pass.
Agency, he told the MP.
Pass, the Spec 4 replied.
So, where are we going, Mr. C?
Africa, via the Azores.
Chapter 51. Investigations. The meeting with the Senate leadership went predictably. Issuing them surgical masks had set the tone of the evening for them. Again, Van Damme's idea. General Pickett had been to Hopkins to review procedures there, then flown back to give the main part of the briefing. The 15 senators assembled in the East Room listened gravely, only their eyes showing above the masks.
"I'm not comfortable with your actions, Mr. President," one of them said.
Jack couldn't tell which one.
"You think I am?" he replied.
"If anybody has a better idea, let's hear it. I have to go with the best medical advice. If this thing is as deadly as the general says, then any mistake could kill people in the thousands, even millions. If we err, we have to err on the side of caution."
"But what about civil liberties?" another one demanded.
"Does any of those come before life?" Jack asked.
"People, if anyone wants to give me a better option, I will listen. We have one of our experts here to help evaluate it. But I will not listen to objections that are not based on scientific fact. The Constitution and the law cannot anticipate every eventuality. In cases like this, we're supposed to use our heads."
"We're supposed to be guided by principle."
It was the civil liberties senator again.
"Fine, then let's talk about it. If there's a balance between what I have done and whatever else will keep the country moving and safe, let's find it. I want options. Give me something I can use."
There followed a silence and a lot of crossed looks. Even that was hard. The senators were spaced out in their seating.
"Why did you have to move so fast?"
"People may be dying, you jackass," another senator snarled at his good friend and distinguished colleague. He had to be one of the new crop, Jack thought, someone who didn't know the mantras yet.
"But what if you're wrong?" a voice asked.
"Then you can hold your impeachment trial after the House indicts me," Jack replied. "Then somebody else can make these decisions, and God help him. Senators, my wife is in Hopkins right now, and she's going to take her turn treating these people. I don't like that either. I would like to have your support. It's lonely standing up by myself like this. But whether you support your president or not, I have to do the best I can. I'll say it one more time. If anybody here has a better idea, let's hear it." But nobody did. And it wasn't their fault. As little time as he'd had to come to terms with the situation, they'd had less. The Air Force had managed tropical uniforms for them out of the Andrews Post Exchange, a medium-sized department store, since their Washington clothes were a little too heavy for a tropical environment. It made for good cover, too. Clark wore the silver eagles of a colonel, and Chavez was a major, complete with silver pilot's wings and ribbons donated by the flight crew of their VC-20B. There were, in fact, two sets of pilots. The backup crew was sleeping in the two most forward passenger seats.
"Not bad for a retired E-6," Ding noted, though the uniform didn't fit all that well. "Not bad for a retired E-7 either, and that's sir to you, Major Chavez."
"Three bags full, sir."
It was their only light moment. The military version of the Gulfstream business jet had a ton of communications gear, and a sergeant to run it. The documents coming over the equipment threatened to exhaust the onboard supply of paper as they passed over Cape Verde, inbound to Kinshasa.
"Second stop is Kenya, sir."
The communications sergeant was really an intelligence specialist. She read all the inbound traffic.
"You have to see a man about some monkeys."
Clark took the page. He was the colonel, after all, and read it, while Chavez figured out how the ribbons went on the blue uniform shirt. He decided he didn't have to be too careful. It wasn't as though the Air Force were really a military service.
at least according to the army in which he'd once served, where it was an article of faith.
"Check this out," John said, handing the page over.
"That's a lead, Mr. C," Ding observed at once.
They traded a look. This was a pure intelligence mission, one of the few on which they'd been dispatched. They were tasked to gather vitally important information for their country and nothing else. For now. Though they didn't say so, neither would have objected to doing something more. Though both were field officers of the CIA's Directorate of Operations, both were also former combat soldiers. In Clark's case, a former SEAL, who more often than not dropped into the DO's paramilitary side, where they did things that the pure spooks regarded as a little too exciting. But often satisfying, Chavez told himself. Very satisfying. He was learning to control his temper. In fact, that part of his genetic heritage, as he called it now, had always been under tight control. But it didn't stop him from thinking about finding whoever it was who had attacked his country, and then dealing with him as soldiers did.
"You know him better than I do, John. What's he going to do?"
"Jack?" Clark shrugged.
"That depends on what we get for him, Domingo. That's our job, remember?"
"Yes, sir," the younger man said seriously. The president did not sleep well that night, though he told himself, and was told by others, that sleep was a prerequisite to making good decisions, and that, everyone emphasized, was his only real function. It was what the citizens expected him to do above all other things. He'd only had about 6 hours the previous day, after an exhausting schedule of travel and speeches, but even so, sleep came hard. His staff and the staffs of many other federal agencies slept less, because, as sweeping as the executive orders were, they had to be implemented in a practical world, and that meant interpretation of the orders in the context of a living nation. A final complication was the fact that there was a problem with the two Chinas, who were 13 hours ahead of Washington. Another potential problem with India, 10 hours ahead, and the Persian Gulf, 8 hours ahead. In addition to the major crisis in America, which stretched across 7 time zones all by itself, if one counted Hawaii, or even more if you added lingering possessions in the Pacific. Lying in bed on the residence floor of the White House, Ryan's mind danced around the globe, finally wondering what part of the world wasn't an area of some kind of concern. Around 3, he gave up the effort and rose, put on casual clothes, and headed to the West Wing for the signals office, with members of the detail in tow. "What's happening?" he asked the senior officer present. It was Major Charles Cannon, USMC, who'd been the one to inform him of the Iraqi assassination, which had seemed to start everything, he remembered. People started to jump to their feet. Jack waved them back into their seats.
"As you were."
"Busy night, sir. Sure you want to be up for all this?" the Major asked.
"I don't feel much like sleeping, Major," Ryan replied.
The 3 service agents behind him made faces behind Swordsman's back. They knew better, even if POTUS didn't.
"Okay, Mr. President. We're linked in now with CDC and USAMRID communications lines, so we're copying all their data.
On the map there, we have all the cases plotted." Cannon pointed. Someone had installed a new large map of the United States mounted on a corkboard. Red pushpins obviously designated Ebola cases. There was a supply of black ones, too, whose import was all too obvious, though none were on the board yet. The pins were mainly clustered in 18 cities now, with seemingly random singles and pairs spread all over the map. There were still a number of states untouched. Idaho, Alabama, both the Dakotas, even, strangely, Minnesota with its Mayo Clinic, were among the states so far protected by Ryan's executive order. Or chance. How did one tell the difference? There were several computer printouts. The printers were all running now. Ryan picked one up. The victim, patients, were listed alphabetically by name, by state, by city, and by occupation. Roughly 15% of them were in the maintenance custodial category, and that was the largest statistical grouping other than sales marketing. This data came from the FBI and CDC, which were working together to study patterns of infection. Another printout showed suspected sites of infection, and that confirmed General Pickett's statement that trade shows had been selected as primary targets. In all his time at CIA, Ryan had studied all manner of theoretical attacks against his country. Somehow, this sort had never made it to his desk. Biological warfare was beyond the pale. He'd spent thousands of hours thinking about nuclear attack. What we had, what they had, what targets, what casualties, the hundreds of possible targeting options selected for political, military, or economic factors. And for each option, there was a range of possible outcomes, depending on weather, time of year, time of day, and other variables, until the result could be addressed only by computers. And even then, the likely results were only expressions of probability calculations. He'd hated every moment of that, and rejoiced at the end of the Cold War and its constant implied threat of mega-deaths. He'd even lived through a crisis that might have led that far. The nightmares from that, he remembered. The president had never taken a course in government per se, just the usual political science courses at Boston College in pursuit of his first degree in economics. Mainly he remembered the words of an aristocratic planter, written almost 30 years before his ascension to become the country's third president. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That was the mission statement right there. The Constitution he'd sworn to preserve, protect, and defend was itself designed to preserve, protect, and defend the lives and rights of the people out there. And he wasn't supposed to be here going over lists of names and places and occupations of people, at least 80% of whom were going to die. They were entitled to their lives. They were entitled to their liberty. They were entitled to the pursuit, by which Jefferson had meant the vocation of, not the chase after, of happiness. Well, somebody was taking lives. Ryan had ordered the suspension of their liberty. Sure as hell not many were happy right now. Here's actually a little bit of good news, Mr. President. Cannon handed over the previous day's election results. It startled Ryan. He'd allowed himself to forget about that. Someone had compiled a list of the winners by profession, and less than half of them were lawyers. 27 were physicians. 23 were engineers. 19 were farmers. 18 were teachers. 14 were businessmen of one sort or another. Well, that was something, wasn't it? Now he had about a third of a House of Representatives. How to get them to Washington, he wondered. They could not be impeded from that. The Constitution was explicit on that issue. While Pat Martin might argue that the suspension of interstate travel had never been argued before the High Court, the Constitution mandated that members of the Congress could not be stopped from coming to a session except on cause of treason. Something like that. Jack couldn't remember exactly, but he knew that congressional immunity was a big deal. Then a telex machine started chattering. An Army Spec 5 walked over to it. "Flash traffic from state, from Ambassador Williams in India," he announced. "Let's see." Ryan walked over too. It wasn't good news. Neither was the next one from Taipei. The physicians were working 4-hour shifts. For every young resident, there was a senior staff member. They were largely doing nurses' work, and though they mainly were doing it well, they also knew that it wouldn't matter all that much. It was Kathy's first time in a spacesuit. She'd operated on 30 or so AIDS patients for eye complications of their disease, but that hadn't been terribly difficult. You used regular gloves, and the only real worry was the number of hands allowed in the surgical field. And for ophthalmic surgery, that wasn't nearly the problem it was for thoracic. You went a little slower, were a little more careful in your movements, but that was it, really. Not now. Now she was in a big, thick plastic bag, wearing a helmet whose clear faceplate often fogged from her breath, looking at patients who were going to die despite the attention of Professor Rank physicians. But they had to try anyway. She was looking down at the local index case, the Winnebago dealer whose wife was in the next room. There were two IVs running, one of fluids and electrolytes and morphine, the other of whole blood, both held rigidly in place so as not to damage the steel vein interface. The only thing they could do was to support. It had once been thought that interferon might help, but that hadn't worked. Antibiotics didn't touch viral diseases, a fact which was not widely appreciated. There was nothing else, though 100 people were now examining options in their labs. No one had ever taken the time with Ebola. CDC, the Army, and a few other labs across the world had done some work, but there hadn't been the effort devoted to other diseases that raged through civilized countries. In America and Europe, research priority went to diseases that killed many, or which attracted a lot of political attention, because the allocation of government research money was a political act. And for private funding, it tracked with what rich or prominent person had been unlucky. Myasthenia gravis had killed Aristotle Onassis, and the resultant funding, while not fast enough to help the shipping magnet, had made significant progress almost overnight. Largely luck, Dr. Ryan knew, but true even so, and a blessing to other victims. The same principle extended to oncology, where the funding for breast cancer, which attacked roughly 1 woman in 10, far outstripped research in prostate cancer, which afflicted roughly half of the male population. A huge amount went into childhood cancers, which were statistically quite rare. Only 12 cases a year per 100,000 kids. But what was more valuable than a child? Nobody objected to that. Certainly she did not. It came down to minuscule funding for Ebola and other tropical diseases, because they didn't have a high profile in the countries which spent the money. That would change now, but not soon enough for the patients filling up the hospital. The patient started gagging and turned to his right. Kathy grabbed the plastic trash can, Emesis trays were too small and tended to spill, and held it for him. Bile and blood, she saw. Black blood. Dead blood. Blood full of the little crystalline bricks of Ebola virus. When he was done, she gave him a water container, the sort with a straw that gave a little bit of water from a squeeze. Just enough to wet his mouth.
"Thanks," the patient groaned.
His skin was pale except in the places where it was blotched from subcutaneous bleeding. Petechiae. Must be Latin, Kathy thought. A dead language's word to designate the sign of approaching death. He looked at her, and he knew. He had to know. The pain was fighting up against the border of the current morphine dosage, reaching his consciousness in waves, like the battering of a tide against a seawall.
"How am I doing?" he asked.
"Well, you're pretty sick," Kathy told him. "But you're fighting back very well. If you can hang in there long enough, your immune system can beat this thing down. But you have to hang tough for us." And that wasn't quite a lie.
"I don't know you. You a nurse?"
"No, I'm actually a professor." She smiled at him through the plastic shield.
"Be careful," he told her. "You really don't want this. Trust me."
He even managed to smile back in the way that severely afflicted patients did, It nearly tore Kathy's heart from her chest.
"We're being careful. Sorry about the suit."
She so needed to touch the man, to show that she really did care. And you couldn't do that through rubber and plastic, damn it.
"Hurts real bad, Doc."
"Lie back. Sleep as much as you can. Let me adjust the morphine for you."
She walked to the other side of the bed to increase the drip, waiting a few minutes before his eyes closed. Then she walked back to the bucket and sprayed it with a harsh chemical disinfectant. The container was already soaked in it, to the point that the chemical had impregnated the plastic, and anything alive that fell into it would quickly be extinguished. Spraying the 30 or so cc's that he'd brought up was probably unnecessary, but there was no such thing as too many precautions now. A nurse came in and handed over the printout with the newest blood work. The patient's liver function was nearly off the scale, automatically highlighted by asterisks as though she wouldn't have noticed. Ebola had a nasty affinity for that organ. Other chemical indicators confirmed the start of systemic necrosis. The internal organs had started to die, the tissues to rot, eaten by the tiny virus strands. It was theoretically possible that his immune system could still summon its energy and launch a counterattack. But that was only theory. One chance in several hundred. Some patients did fight this off. It was in the literature which she and her colleagues had studied over the last 12 hours. And in that case, they were already speculating. If they could isolate the antibodies, they might have something they could use therapeutically. If, maybe, might, could, possibly. That wasn't medicine as she knew it. Certainly it wasn't the clean, antiseptic medicine she practiced at Wilmer, fixing eyes, restoring and perfecting sight. She thought again about her decision to enter ophthalmology. One of her professors had pressed her hard to look at oncology. She had the brains, she had the curiosity, she had the gift for connecting things, he'd told her. But looking down at this sleeping, dying patient, she knew that no, she didn't have the heart to do this every day. Not to lose so many. So did that make her a failure? Kathy Ryan asked herself. With this patient, she had to admit, yes, it did.
Damn, Chavez said, it's like Colombia.
Or Vietnam, Clark agreed on being greeted with the tropical heat. There was an embassy official and a representative of the Zaire government. The latter wore a uniform and saluted the arriving officers, which courtesy John returned.
"This way, if you please, Colonel."
The helicopter, it turned out, was French, and the service was excellent. America had dropped a lot of money into this country. It was payback time now. Clark looked down. Triple canopy jungle. He'd seen that before in more than one country. In his youth he'd been underneath, looking for enemies, and with enemies looking for him. Little men in black pajamas or khaki uniforms, carrying AK-47s, people who wanted to take his life. Now he appreciated the fact that there was something down there even smaller, that was not carrying any weapon, and was targeted not merely on him, but at the heart of his country. It seemed so damned unreal. John Clark was a creature of his country. He'd been wounded in combat operations and other, more personal events, and every time was restored quickly to full health. There had been that one time when he'd rescued an A-6 pilot up some river in North Vietnam whose name he couldn't remember anymore. He'd gotten cut, and the polluted river had infected him. And that had been fairly unpleasant. But drugs and time had fixed it. He'd come away from all the experiences with a deeply held belief that his country produced doctors who could fix just about anything. Not old age, and not cancer, yet. But they were working on it. And in due course they'd win their battles, as he'd won most of his. That was an illusion. He had to admit that now. As he and his country had lost their struggle in a jungle like this one, 1,000 feet below the racing helicopter, so now the jungle was reaching out somehow. No, he shook that off. The jungle wasn't reaching out. People had done that. The 4 row-row ships formed up 600 miles north-northwest of Diego Garcia. They were in a box formation, spaced 1,000 yards abeam and 1,000 yards fore and aft. The destroyer O'Bannon took position 5,000 yards dead ahead. Kidd was 10,000 yards northeast of the ASW ship, with Anzio 20 miles in advance of the rest. The replenishment group with its 2 frigates was westbound and would join up around sunset. It was a good opportunity for an exercise. 6 P-3C Orion aircraft were based at Diego Garcia. The number had once been larger. And one of them was patrolling ahead of the mini-convoy, dropping sonobuoys, a complex undertaking for so rapidly moving a formation, and listening for possible submarines. Another Orion was well in advance, tracking the Indian Navy's 2-carrier battle group from their radar emissions while staying well out of detection range. The lead Orion was not armed with anything but anti-sub weapons at the moment, and its mission was routine surveillance.
"Yes, Mr. President," the J-3 said. "Why aren't you asleep, Jack?" he couldn't say. "Robbie, did you see this thing from Ambassador Williams?"
"It got my attention," Admiral Jackson confirmed.
David Williams had taken his time drafting the communique. That had annoyed people at State and caused 2 requests for his report which he had ignored. The former governor was drawing on all of his political savvy to consider the words the Prime Minister had chosen, her tone, her body language, the look in her eyes most of all. There was no substitute for that. Dave Williams had learned that lesson more than once. One thing he hadn't learned was diplomatic verbiage. His report was straight from the shoulder, and his conclusion was that India was up to something. He further noted that the Ebola crisis in America had not come up, not a word of sympathy. That, he wrote, was probably a mistake in one sense, and a very deliberate act in another. India should have cared about it, or should have expressed concern, even if she didn't. Instead, it had been ignored. If asked, the Prime Minister would have said that she hadn't yet been informed. But that would be a lie, Williams added. In the age of CNN, things like that never went unnoticed. Instead, she had harped on being bullied by America, reminded him of the attack on her navy not once, but twice, and then extended the remark into calling it an unfriendly act, a phrase used in diplomacy right before a hand descended toward the holster. He concluded that India's naval exercise was not a mistake in either timing or location. The message he'd received was, "In your face."
"So what do you think, Rob?"
"I think Ambassador Williams is one shrewd son of a bitch, sir. The only thing he didn't say is something he didn't know. We don't have a carrier there. Now, the Indians haven't been tracking us in any way, but it's public knowledge that Ike is heading toward China. And if their intel officers are halfway competent, they definitely do know. Then, shazam, they put out to sea. And now we get this from the ambassador."
"Sure."
"Stow that, Robbie," Ryan told him. "You've said that enough for one day."
"Fine.
Jack, we have every reason to believe that China and India were working together before. So what happens now? China stages an incident. It gets nastier. We move a carrier. The Indians put to sea. Their fleet is on a direct line between Diego Garcia and the Persian Gulf. The Persian Gulf heats up."
"And we have a plague," Ryan added.
He leaned forward on the cheap desk in signals. He couldn't sleep, but that didn't mean he was fully awake either.
"Coincidences?"
"Maybe. Maybe the Indian Prime Minister is pissed at us because we rattled their cage a while back. Maybe she just wants to show us that we can't push her around. Maybe it's petty bullshit, Mr. President. But maybe it ain't.
Options?
We have a surface action group in the Eastern Med. 2 Aegis cruisers, a Burke-class can, and 3 figs. The Med's quiet. I suggest that we consider moving that group through Suez to back up the Anzio group. I further suggest that we consider moving a carrier from Westlant to the Med. That will take a while, Jack. It's 6,000 miles. Even with a speed of advance of 25 knots, that's almost 9 days just to get a carrier close. We have more than a third of the world without a carrier handy, and the part that isn't covered is starting to make me nervous. If we have to do something, Jack, I'm not sure we can.
Hello, sister, Clark said, taking her hand gently. He hadn't seen a nun in quite a few years.
Welcome, Colonel Clark.
Major? She nodded to Chavez. Afternoon, ma'am.
What brings you to our hospital?
Sister Mary Charles's English was excellent, almost as though she taught it, with a Belgian accent that sounded just like French to the two Americans.
Sister, we're here to ask about the death of one of your colleagues, Sister Jean-Baptiste, Clark told her.
I see.
She waved to the chairs.
Please sit down.
Thank you, sister, Clark said politely.
You are Catholic? She asked.
It was important to her.
Yes, ma'am, we both are.
Chavez nodded agreement with the colonel.
Your education?
Actually, all Catholic schools for me, Clark said, indulging her. Grade school was the school Sisters of Notre Dame, and Jesuits after that.
Ah.
She smiled, pleased at the news.
I have heard of the sickness that has broken out in your country. This is very sad. And so you are here to ask about poor Benedict Macusa, Sister Jean, and Sister Maria Magdalena. But I fear we cannot be of much help to you.
Why is that, sister?
Benedict died, and his body was cremated on government order, Sister Mary Charles explained. Jean was taken ill, yes, but she left for Paris on a medical evacuation flight, you see, to visit the Pasteur Institute. The airplane crashed into the sea, however, and all were lost.
All? Clark asked.
Sister Maria Magdalena flew off also, and Dr. Moody, of course.
Who was he? John inquired next.
He was part of the World Health Organization mission to this area. Some of his colleagues are in the next building, she pointed.
Moody, you said, ma'am? Chavez asked, taking his notes.
Yes.
She spelled it for him.
Mohammed Moody. A good doctor, she added. It was very sad to lose them all.
Mohammed Moody, you said? Any idea where he was from? It was Chavez again.
Iran. No, that's just changed, hasn't it? He was educated in Europe, a fine young physician, and very respectful of us.
I see. Clark adjusted himself in his seat. Could we talk with his colleagues?
I think the president's gone much too far, the doctor said on TV. He had to be interviewed in a local affiliate, since he was unable to drive from Connecticut to New York this morning.
Why is that, Bob? The host asked.
He'd come in from his home in New Jersey to the New York studio off Central Park West, just before the bridges and tunnels had been closed, and was sleeping in his office now. Understandably, he wasn't very happy about it.
Ebola is a nasty one. There's no doubt of that, said the network's medical correspondent. He was a physician who didn't practice, though he spoke the language quite well. He mainly presented medical news in the morning, concentrating on the benefits of jogging and good diet. But it's never been here, and the reason is that the virus can't survive here. However, these people contracted it, and for the moment I will leave speculation on that aside. It can't spread very far. I'm afraid the president's actions are precipitous. And unconstitutional, the legal correspondent added. There's no doubt of that. The president has panicked, and that's not good for the country in medical or legal terms.
Thanks a bunch, fellas, Ryan said, muting the set.
We have to work on this, Arnie said.
How?
You fight bad information with good information.
Super, Arnie, except that proving I did the right thing means people have to die.
We have a panic to prevent, Mr. President.
So far, that hadn't happened, which was remarkable. Timing had helped. The news had mainly hit people in the evening. For the most part, they'd gone home. They had enough food in the pantry to see them through a few days, and the news had shocked enough that there had not been a nationwide raid on supermarkets. Those things would change today, however. In a few hours, people would be protesting. The news media would cover that, and some sort of public opinion would form. Arnie was right. He had to do something about it. But what?
How, Arnie?
Jack, I thought you'd never ask. The next stop was the airport. There it was confirmed that, yes, a privately owned, Swiss-registered G4 business jet had indeed lifted off with a flight plan taking it to Paris via Libya for refueling. The chief controller had a Xerox copy of the airport records and the aircraft's manifest ready for the visiting Americans. It was a remarkably comprehensive document, since it had to allow for customs control as well. Even the names for the flight crew were on it.
Well? Chavez asked.
Clark looked at the officials. Thank you for your valuable assistance. Then he and Ding headed for the car that would take them to their aircraft.
Well? Ding repeated.
Cool it, partner. The five-minute ride passed in silence. Clark looked out the window. Thunderheads were building. He hated flying in the things.
No way. We wait a few minutes.
The backup pilot was a lieutenant colonel.
We have rules.
Clark tapped the eagles on his epaulets and leaned right into his face.
Me colonel. Me say go, air scout. Right the fuck now.
Look, Mr. Clark, I know who you are and...
Sir, Chavez said, I'm only an artificial major, but this mission's more important than your rules. Steer around the worst parts, will you? We have barf bags if we need 'em.
The pilot glared at them, but moved back into the front office. Chavez turned.
Temper, John.
Clark handed over the paper.
Check the names for the flight crew. They ain't Swiss, and the registration of the aircraft is.
Chavez looked for that. HXNJA was the registration code, and the names for the flight crew weren't Germanic, Gallic, or Italian.
Sergeant? Clark called as the engine started up.
Yes, sir.
The NCO had seen this man tear the driver a new asshole.
Fax this to Langley, please. You have the right number to use. Quick as you can, ma'am, he added, since she was a lady and not just a sergeant. The NCO didn't get it, but didn't mind either.
Cinch those belts in tight, the pilot called over the intercom as the VC-20B started to taxi. It took three tries because of electrical interference from the storm, but the facsimile transmission went through the satellite, downlinked to Fort Belvoir, Virginia, and reappeared in Mercury, the agency's communication nexus. The senior watch officer had his deputy run it to the seventh floor. By that time, Clark was on the phone to him.
Getting some interference, the watch officer said.
Digital satellite radio and all, a thunderstorm was still a thunderstorm.
It's a little bumpy at the moment. Run the registration number and the names on that manifest.
Everything you can get on them.
Say again.
Clark did. It got through this time.
Will do. Somebody's got a file on this. Anything else?
Back to you later.
Out,
he heard.
So? Ding asked, reefing his belt in tighter as the G took a 10-foot drop.
Those names are in Farsi, Ding.
Oh, shit.
Another major bump. He looked out the window. It was like a huge arena, a cylindrical formation of clouds with lightning all over the place. It wasn't often he looked down at that.
The bastard's doing this on purpose.
But he wasn't. The lieutenant colonel on the controls was scared. Air Force regulations, not to mention common sense, prohibited what he was doing. The weather radar in the nose showed red 20 degrees left and right of his projected course to Nairobi. Left looked better. He turned 30 degrees, banking the executive jet like a fighter, searching for a smooth spot as he continued the climb out. What he found wasn't smooth, but it was better. 10 minutes later, the VC-20B broke into sunlight. One of the spare pilots turned in her front-row seat. "Satisfied, Colonel?" she asked. Clark unbuckled his belt in defiance of the sign and went to the lavatory to splash water in his face. Then he knelt down on the floor next to her and showed her the paper that had just been transmitted.
"Can you tell me anything about this?" She only needed one look.
"Oh, yeah," the captain said. "We got a notice on that."
"What?"
"This is essentially the same aircraft. When one breaks, the manufacturer tells everybody about it. I mean, we'd ask anyway, but it's almost automatic. He came out of here, flew north to Libya, landed to refuel, right? Took off right away, practically. Medical flight, I think, wasn't it?"
"Correct. Go on."
"He called emergency, said he lost power on one engine, then the other, and went in. 3 radars tracked it. Libya, Malta, and a Navy ship. Destroyer, I think."
"Anything funny about it, Captain?"
She shrugged. "This is a good airplane. I don't think the military's ever broke one. You just saw how good. A couple of those bumps were 2.5, maybe 3 G's, and the engines. Jerry, have we ever lost an engine in flight on a 20?
"Twice, I think. First one there was a defect on the fuel pump. Rolls-Royce sent out a fix on all of those. The other one, it was in November a few years back. They ate a goose."
"That'll do it every time," she told Clark. "Goose weighs maybe 15-20 pounds. We try to keep clear of them."
"This guy lost both engines, though."
"They haven't figured out why yet. Maybe bad fuel. That happens, but the engines are isolated units, sir. Separate everything. Pumps, electronics, you name it."
"Except fuel," Jerry said. "That all comes out of one truck."
"What else? What happens when you lose an engine?"
"If you're not careful, you can lose control. You get a full shutdown, the aircraft yaws into the dead engine. That changes airflow over the control surfaces. We lost a Lear, a VC-21, that way once. If it catches you in a transition maneuver when it happens, well, then it can get a little bit exciting. But we trained for that, and the flight crew on this one, that was in the report. They were both experienced drivers, and they go in the box, the training simulator, pretty regular. You have to, or they take your insurance away. Anyway, the radar didn't show them maneuvering. So no, that shouldn't have done it to them. The best guess was bad fuel, but the Libyan said the fuel was okay."
"Unless the crew just totally screwed up," Jerry added. "But even that's hard. I mean, they make these things so you really have to try to break 'em, you know. I got 2,000 hours.
2.5 for me," the captain said. "It's safer in driving a car in D.C., sir. We all love these things." Clark nodded and went forward.
"Enjoying the ride?" the pilot in command said over his shoulder. His voice wasn't exactly friendly, and he didn't exactly have to worry about insubordination. Not with an officer wearing his own ribbons.
"I don't like leaning on people, Colonel. This is very important shit. That's all I can say. My wife's a nurse in the base hospital." He didn't have to say more. He was worried about her.
"So's mine, down in Williamsburg."
The pilot turned on learning that and nodded at his passenger.
"No real harm done. 3 hours to Nairobi, Colonel."
"Well, how do I get back?" Raymond asked over the phone.
"You don't for now," Andrea told him. "Sit tight. Maybe you can help the FBI with the investigation they have running."
"Well, that's just great."
"Deal with it, Jeff. I don't have time for this," she told her subordinate crossly.
"Sure." He hung up.
That was odd, Andrea thought. Jeff was always one of the cool ones. But who was cool at the moment?
Chapter 52. Something of Value. "Ever been here before, John?" Chavez asked as their aircraft descended to meet its shadow on the runway.
"Passed through once. Didn't see much more than the terminal."
Clark slipped off his belt and stretched. Sunset was descending here, too, and with it, not the end of a very long day for the two intelligence officers.
"Most of what I know comes from books by a guy named Ruark, hunting and stuff."
"You don't hunt. Not animals, anyway," Ding added.
"Used to.
I still like reading about it.
Nice to hunt things that don't shoot back."
John turned with part of a smile.
"Not as exciting.
Safer, maybe," the junior agent allowed.
How dangerous could a lion really be, he wondered.
The rollout took them to the military terminal. Kenya had a small air force, though what it did was a mystery to the visiting CIA Air Force officers, and seemed likely to remain so. The aircraft was met, again, by an embassy official, this one the defense attaché, a black army officer with the rank of colonel, and a combat infantryman's badge that marked him as a veteran of the Persian Gulf War.
"Colonel Clark, Major Chavez?"
Then his voice stopped.
"Chavez, do I know you?"
"Ninja," Ding grinned. "You were brigade staff then, first of the 7th.
"Cold Steel. You're one of the guys who got lost. I guess they found you."
"Relax, gentlemen. I know where you're from, but our hosts do not," the officer warned.
"Where's the CIB from, Colonel?" the former staff sergeant asked on the walk over to where the cars were.
"I had a battalion of the Big Red One in Iraq. We kicked a few and took a few."
Then his mood changed.
"So how are things at home?"
"Scary," Ding replied.
"Something to remember. Bio-war is mainly a psychological weapon, like the threat of gas was against us back in 91.
"Maybe so," Clark responded. "It sure as hell's got my attention, Colonel."
"Got mine, too," the defense attaché admitted. "I got family in Atlanta. CNN says there's cases there."
"Read fast." John handed over the last data sent to them on the airplane.
"This ought to be better than what's on TV."
Not that better was the right word, he thought.
The colonel rated a driver, it seemed. He took the front seat in the embassy car and flipped through the pages.
"No official greeting this time?" Chavez asked.
"Not here. We'll have a cop where we're going. I asked my friends in the ministry to low-profile this one. I have some pretty good contacts around town."
"Good call," Clark said as the car started moving. "Getting there only took 10 minutes. The animal dealer had his place of business on the outskirts of the city, conveniently located to the airport and the main highway west end of the bush, but not too close to much else. The CIA officers soon discovered why.
"Christ," Chavez observed, getting out of the car.
"Yeah, they're noisy, aren't they? I was here earlier today. He's getting a shipment of greens ready for Atlanta." He opened a briefcase and handed something over. "Here, you'll need this."
"Right."
Clark slid the envelope into his clipboard.
"Hello," the dealer said, coming out of his office. He was a big man, and, judging by his gut, knew his way around a case of beer. With him was a uniformed police officer, evidently a senior one. The attaché went to speak with him and move him aside. The cop didn't seem to object. This infantry colonel, Clark saw, knew how the game was played.
"Howdy," John said, taking his hand. "I'm Colonel Clark. This is Major Chavez."
"You are American Air Force?"
"That's right, sir," Ding replied.
"I love airplanes. What do you fly?"
"All sorts of things," Clark answered.
The local businessman was already half in the bag.
"We have a few questions, if you don't mind."
"About monkeys? Why are you interested in monkeys? The chief constable didn't explain."
"Is it all that important?" John asked, handing over an envelope.
The dealer pocketed it without opening it to count. He'd felt how thick it was.
"Truly it is not, but I do love to watch airplanes. So what can I tell you?" he asked next, his voice friendly and open.
"You sell monkeys," John said.
"Yes, I deal in them. For zoos, for private collectors, and for medical laboratories. Come, I will show you."
He led them toward a three-sided building made of corrugated iron, it looked like. Two trucks were there, and five workers were loading cages onto it, their hands in thick leather gloves. "We just had an order from your CDC in Atlanta," the dealer explained, "for 100 greens. They are pretty animals, but very unpleasant. The local farmers hate them."
"Why?" Ding asked, looking at the cages.
They were made of steel wire, with handles at the top. From a distance, they appeared to be of the size used to transport chickens to market. Viewed closer, they were a little large for that, but...
"They ravage crops. They are a pest, like rats, but more clever, and people from America think they are gods or something, the way they complain on how they are used in medical experiments."
The dealer laughed.
"As though we would run out of them. There are millions. We raid a place, take 30, and a month later we can come back and take 30 more. The farmers beg us to come and trap them."
"You had a shipment ready for Atlanta earlier this year, but you sold them to someone else, didn't you?" Clark asked. He looked over to his partner, who didn't approach the building. Rather, he separated from Clark and the dealer, and walked on a line away from it. He seemed to be staring at the empty cages. Maybe the smell bothered him. It was pretty thick.
"They did not pay me on time, and another customer came along, and he had his money already," the dealer pointed out. "This is a business, Colonel Clark."
John grinned. "Hey, I'm not here from the Better Business Bureau. I just want to know who you sold them to."
"A buyer," the dealer said. "What else do I need to know?"
"Where was he from?" Clark persisted.
"I do not know. He paid me in dollars, but he was probably not an American. He was a quiet fellow," the dealer remembered. "Not very friendly." "Yes, I know I was late getting the new shipment to Atlanta, but they were late in paying me," he reminded his guest. "You, fortunately, were not."
"They went out by air?"
"Yes, it was an old 707. It was full. They were not just my monkeys. They had gotten them elsewhere, too. You see, the green is so common. It lives all over Africa. Your animal worshippers need not worry about extinction for the green. The gorilla, now, I admit that is something else.
Besides, they mainly lived in Uganda and Rwanda, and more was the pity. People paid real money for them.
Do you have records? The name of the buyer, the manifest, the registration of the airplane?"
"Customs records, you mean?"
He shook his head.
"Sadly, I do not. Perhaps they were lost."
"You have an arrangement with the airport officials," John said with a smile that he didn't feel.
"I have many friends in the government, yes."
Another smile, the sly sort, that confirmed his arrangement. "Well, it wasn't as though there was no such thing as official corruption in America, was it?" Clark thought.
"And you don't know where they went, then?"
"No, there I cannot help you. If I could, I would gladly do so," the dealer replied, patting his pocket,
where the envelope was.
"I regret to say that my records are incomplete for some of my transactions."
Clark wondered if he could press the man further on this issue. He suspected not. He'd never worked Kenya, though he had worked Angola, briefly, in the 1970s, and Africa was a very informal continent, and cash was the lubricant. He looked over to where the defense attaché was talking to the chief constable. The title was a holdover from British rule, which he'd read about in one of Ruark's books, and so were the shorts and knee socks. He was probably confirming that, no, the dealer wasn't a criminal, just creative in his relationships with local authorities, who, for a modest fee, looked the other way when asked. And monkeys were hardly a vital national commodity, assuming the dealer was truthful about the numbers of the things. And he probably was. It sounded true. The farmers would probably be just as happy to be rid of the damn things, just to make the noise stop. It sounded like a riot in the biggest bar in town on a Friday night. And they were nasty little bastards, reaching and snapping at the gloved hands transferring the cages. What the hell? They were having a bad day. And on getting to CDC Atlanta, it wouldn't get much better, would it? Were they smart enough to know? Damn sure Clark knew. You didn't ship this many to pet stores.